One of the primary reasons that people come to spiritual practice, in my experience, certainly my case as well, is to find some relief from obsessive thinking, repetitive thoughts. Along with impulse control, it's probably one of the most driving forces that propel us into seeking new solutions in life. Interestingly, given how much time we're going to spend with our thoughts in our life, we are given very little education as to how to relieve ourselves when intrusive, repetitive, obsessive ideation comes about. Very often, because we don't even understand the process that brings about these thoughts, we tend to view ourselves almost as victims of our thinking, as if the mind is trying to get us. And we often come to spiritual practice with only a couple of ways to relate or work with domineering thoughts, such as fear, worry, anxiety, anger, resentment. And these practices we bring boil down to very often either we resist them, we try to ignore them, shut them up, argue with them, or B, we react, we act out on them, we give up and say, okay, I'll just do anything to shut this voice up. And of course, these two strategies in a way mirror what the Buddha was addressing when he talked about the unskillful strategies that we have in life are based on black and white thinking, where we either try to find all of our happiness by just giving in to our addictions and our cravings and our lusts, or B, we try to completely fight, resist, push away, deny ourselves. And these twin polars, approaches to life, approaches to the mind, do not work that well. So the Buddha presented a different way of dealing with obsessions, a different way of dealing with those thoughts that happen over and over and over again that feel like unwanted visitors. For the next 3 weeks, I'm going to be talking about three different tools for dealing with obsessions. And these three tools are not taught that often. There are many tools that are popular with Buddhist teachers these days, such as Vipassana and concentration. And those are very wonderful tools. But I've always been somebody who likes to have as many tools as possible. If I hire a carpenter, I like to see somebody who comes over to my house with more than just a hammer to do the job, because that doesn't build in me much confidence. But if they have a nice big overflowing toolkit, I sort of have a little bit more confidence that they'll know what they're doing and have all the tools available. So my job is just to give you as many tools, and it's up to you which ones you work with and which ones you don't. Tonight's tool is called, by the Buddha, Yonisa Manasikara. And what that means is appropriate reflection. And it's a way to relate to our thoughts in a different way than we normally do. The Buddha listed this kind of reflection as key to achieving any form of enlightenment. It's the second factor of seven in enlightenment. It's also, the Buddha said in one memorable sutta that if we don't know how to deal with our thoughts, what will happen is citta kandati vitaka, which means your thoughts will chew your mind up. It's actually, I have to say, in my experience, that's pretty true. That without practicing various new ways of working with obsessive ideation, our thoughts can multiply, can be triggered, and before we know it, we can be in various forms of anxiety and fear spirals that are very difficult to work our way out of because we're in the same mind with the fear or anger. So to teach the five questions of Yoniso Manasikara, I'm going to use an analogy. And the analogy is, there's a party in your head. You're throwing a party in your head. And because it's in your head, you got there first. You're the first person at the party. So hopefully you've got a nice, comfortable place to sit at your party in your head. Is there a Talking Heads song like Party in My Mind or something like that? Nobody knows. Nobody cares about that group. I think there might have been, so don't blame me for the metaphor. It's a nice one. So there's all these guests that arrive at this party in your mind. Some guests you like. One guest is, I'm terrific, thought. I'm really swell. People like me. I'm really doing well. I got my shit down. Might even be, oh boy, you're looking pretty hot today. Maybe I'll take my photo for Facebook. Obviously, a lot of us like that thought because we act out on it. Some of us have the thought, everything I do is interesting, so I'll post an image of my lunch. I'm always curious about that. But and it's all right if you've done that. No, it's not. It's not all right. I don't have that power to forgive you. So we have a lot of visitors, and some of them are really like. Some of them are visitors we don't really care about. They're like, ooh, what did I do today? Or what am I going to do tomorrow? Or whatever sort of, who's that? Whatever thoughts we have. But then we have also the unwanted visitors that come to the party upstairs in our head. They're the, I wonder what that person's thinking about me. I wonder how I compare with others. I wonder what's going to happen to me in the future. Why the fuck is that person such an asshole? Why did I do this? I suck. Boy, do I really suck today. One of my persistent visitors for years was, the first thought in the morning was, boy, do you look bald today. I got to know that visitor intimately. So we all have a lot of arrivals in this gathering. So there are five ways we can investigate or relate to these thoughts, these impulses, these ideas. The first is to ask what brings about this thought. What is the thing that we do right before it arises that is, in essence, its cause? The Buddha didn't look at things in isolation. He looked always in terms of the relationship that things have with other events. He never saw anything in terms of just an isolated event that comes about on his own. In the Buddha's view of the world, everything has a cause in our, especially in the mind. The mind is basically a causal environment. So, for example, very often when we're not allowing ourselves to feel sadness, anger will arise when we're closing the door on any experience that's been depressing or hard, We don't want to feel those feelings of a breakup, a loss, a separation, a rejection. We're running away, and we didn't invite that feeling to the party. That feeling will send its friend anger. And anger is what arises when we don't allow ourselves to feel sadness or loss or grief. When we're overbalanced in the world, where we're trying to get all our happiness from a relationship or from a career, fear will visit us. Because any time we're overbalanced, we've thrown all our eggs spiritually in one basket, that we know that we're vulnerable, and so fear will inevitably result. Clinical psychology shows us that a recent study by Harvard demonstrates that when we don't assign ourselves a task, when we simply allow the mind to wander, generally what will arise will be self-centered fixation in terms of what do other people think about me or what's going to happen to me in the future. That's where the mind tends to wind up. So when we don't stand or keep some awareness of what we're doing at the party, a lot of self-centered thoughts will come in. If we're trying to not invite sorrow, then anger will come in. If we are overly fixated on achievement or approval or fame or money, then fear will rise. And if you begin to see what perceptions or what we're doing and how it brings about these obsessive thoughts, then we, first of all, we don't experience ourselves as so much of a victim of our thoughts. We actually begin to realize, well, okay, I actually have a choice here. There's something I can do about it. For instance, if we really are concerned about craving, which often happens when we invite its friend envy, we sit around envying other people or constantly, you know, checking out all the shit that they have, fixating on what they're getting done, eventually craving will come up. We'll want something that makes all that discomfort to go away. We can go to the root cause. It's a little bit like, to use another analogy in life, if you want to fight crime, what you do is you create employment. Crime rates drop when you create employment for people. If you try to fight simply by throwing people away in jail, it doesn't solve anything. Going after the effect is nowhere near as efficient as going after the cause, the thing that gives rise. So if we notice, for example, that fear is pushing us around, then we should investigate, okay, what am I trying or overbalancing all my attentions towards? For example, what am I fixated on might happen? The second question to ask is, when do these thoughts pass? So what this means is sometimes a visitor will come to your house, and they're one of those people that just walk by, and they don't really care if you notice them. They just are there. You might say hello to them, you might not. Sometimes you've got visitors at your party, though, that they'll come up to you, and you say hi, and then they'll go away. Sometimes if you have a gathering, though, there'll be somebody who'll come up, and they'll really demand that you pay attention to them. They're a little bit self-centered. I'm here. Talk to me. This is very similar to our thoughts. Some thoughts are just idle perceptions, and they'll pass by, and you can note them or not, and they won't really have much of an effect unless you really attach to them. Then you can get in a whole debate or a whole thing with them. Sometimes thoughts, though, require acknowledgement, or what we call in Buddhist practice, noting, and they'll simply go away. To-do lists are like that. If you have a persistent, in your meditation, the first thing that comes up is like, oh, all the shit I should be doing instead of sitting here. The simple thing to do is simply just note it. Oh, okay, I see you. I promise I'll tend to you the moment I stop with this. In most cases, to-do lists will then go, okay, gotcha, I'll come back later. That's all it really wants, is a little bit of noticing. On the other hand, fear, it's not going to go away that easy. Fear really wants your attention. So with fear, sometimes we have to be a little bit more aggressive. We say hello to it, and then we have to replace it with another thought. We have to go to a reflection on how many times our fears haven't come true, or our worries and anxieties haven't come to pass. Sometimes a visitor really needs our attention before it'll go away. And an example of this is sorrow or depression or sadness. Instead of going into the stories, we have to feel the feelings and really open to them before they'll pass. So with each thought, rather than having one single approach to how to deal with thoughts, either rejecting or acting out on them, we have to learn with each different visitor in the mind what it requires before it will give us some space. In most cases, what will work is the practice that we did at the beginning of the sitting today, which is we had a mind, a spacious mind meditation, where we expand awareness down into the body so that we have a greater sense of space, of awareness. The thoughts become then less intrusive when they arise. And this is a very skillful way of relating to thoughts. As the Chinese say, that if you hold a leaf up to your eye, it can seem bigger than the moon. But if you hold it away from your head, it seems very small. The Buddha also said that if you pour a teaspoon of salt into a cup the size, it would make the cup undrinkable. So if the mind is very small, then one thought can take it over. But if awareness is more spacious, if you have more contact with more sensations, then the thought itself will be less dominant. If you pour a teaspoon of salt into a large river, it won't ruin the quality of water. So the more spacious you keep the mind, the more in contact with the breath and the body, the more you can have a different perspective on your thoughts. Now the third question, and this is really helpful, is asking what does each thought promise me? There isn't any single thought or behavior that you have that came about entirely by accident. Every single thought that regularly visits us started out as a coping strategy that worked when we were younger. For example, very often in life as adults, when we're caught acting unskillfully, the first two impulses that might arise might be unskillful. We might want to deny it, even though we know it's true. Or we might want to run and hide and avoid acknowledging the truth. And then the question becomes, well, what the fuck's going on here? I'm an adult. Nothing's going to happen to me. I can simply acknowledge that I made a mistake. Why do I have these thoughts? The reason is that when we were children, avoidance and lying were our two greatest coping strategies. When we're an infant and we get caught, we think that any disapproval from our caretakers might result in our annihilation. We can't afford to acknowledge we've made a mistake. We feel that we might get rejected and, you know, thrust out into the cold, not taken care of. So we pick up these strategies of avoiding getting caught or acknowledging mistakes. And these coping tools, they get brought along with us into our adult lives. The problem is with the human mind is that if any tool works for us ever, no matter how unskillful, it will continue to arise as an idea, as an option. The trick is, first of all, not to take it personally. It doesn't mean anything about you. It simply means that at one point in your life, like everybody else, you developed a series of coping strategies to survive childhood. They're no longer applicable, but that doesn't mean anything about you or your mind. The the core is then to simply note, okay, what do these thoughts have to offer? So let's look at some of them. I'm just going to rifle through a few thoughts that are unskillful and what they offer us. Hypervigilance, the tendency of trying to read people's minds. What does that offer? It offers us the belief that we can somehow figure out what people are thinking and we can thus control them. What does catastrophizing mean? Well, you might say, well, what the fuck does catastrophizing even mean? What does it mean? It means going to the worst case scenario, figuring out all the bad things that can happen to you in any given new challenge. Why do we do it? It seems like it causes a lot of stress. Well, when we go to the worst case possible scenario, we do it because we believe it will make us prepared, that we'll somehow be on guard. What's another good one? Overgeneralizing. That's like that first, you go to your new job and the first day kind of sucks and you think, oh, it's always going to be this bad. Overgeneralizing. Why do we do that? Because again, we feel protected. So all these thoughts offer us the illusion of protection. We believe that they will keep us armored and secure. Another set is blaming and victimization. This gets us off the hook of actually having to acknowledge our own mistakes. And we bring into adult life very often this feeling that we can't even begin to acknowledge that we've made any errors of judgment, because what happens then is we fall into blaming spirals of shame. We don't know how to skillfully criticize our actions. We get caught up in selfing and stories of identity and thinking that we suck. We don't know how to simply say, oh, my actions weren't skillful. So we avoid acknowledging any mistakes at all costs by blaming others and by feeling victimized by life. So addictions, they offer the illusion that all of our problems can magically go away if we just buy a pair of shoes or consume a couple of beers. You get it. Every single visitor in the mind, it's not just visiting us for spite. It's there for a reason. At one point in our lives, it offered us a false sense of security or solution. And if we acknowledge that, then we can begin to see a different ways to proceed. And we can begin to also see, the next question is, what are the drawbacks? For example, catastrophizing or going to the worst case scenario in every situation, we do this because it gives us the illusion that we'll be prepared. But if we reflect each time after we've gone through a spiral of negative thinking, we'll see just how much of our lives we waste worrying about outcomes that never actually occur. And B, in my experience, you never get it right anyway. It never turns out the way you think it's going to be. There's always some unforeseen event or unforeseen outcome. And even if you do, most of the time when we get ourselves worked up into an armored defensive quality of, oh shit, what, this is really going to turn out badly, all of the solutions that come about from that mind kind of suck. In my case, they're always like, well, I could always move to Alaska or something like that. It's, you know, not very helpful. One skillful way of seeing the drawbacks is every single time we go through any kind of obsessive ideation or thinking pattern or repetitive thought, is just stop and just notice it. Don't judge ourselves. Just notice how much time we spend. I only have really one regret in life, and none of it has to do with all the drugs and beer that I consume. My one regret is the times that I've spent worrying about anything. Because in my experience, well, maybe there was a couple of times I worried about being hit by a bus that might have been helpful, but other than that, almost all of that, the fear that I've at one point in my life experienced, was a large waste of time. And the only thing that allowed me to get any distance from fear was simply each time after I would go into a sort of was entrapped by anxiety was just to simply sit and notice what it did to me, how much time it consumed, how much energy it depleted. There's no need to add judgment. There's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with my mind. There's no need to add any sense of shame. There's simply each time sitting and just simply observing and taking it in. Really beginning to see clearly that fear doesn't offer us any real protection. That craving doesn't make any problems go away. It actually just makes our dramas in life even worse. Sometimes we might think that, for example, all the times that we compare ourselves with others, that that helps motivate us. But if you really sit and notice after you've gone through one of those despairing times where you feel like a failure and everybody else seems like they're a massive success in the world, afterwards just notice, well, did it spur any greatness? Did it make me get out of bed? Or then have a day where you take a break from it and see if you still get out of bed and accomplish anything. In my case, the days that I don't beat myself up, which are now much more than they were previously in life, I get much more accomplished. So finally, the fifth and most and last question to ask is, given that all these thoughts arise for a reason, and that they, and most of them have drawbacks, what are useful substitutes? If, for example, I have a lot of craving, for example, craving to purchase, to eat, to stuff myself, to craving to have meaningless sex, craving to fall back into a behavioral pattern that I know does not bring me any peace of mind and just makes me feel trapped by my impulses. Then the skillful thing to do is to look at what hole this is trying to fill and try to instead fill it spiritually or B, with behaviors that will not cause shame afterwards. I try to go first to the spiritual and then to the less spiritual but not shame-inducing. So, for example, if I'm craving the new eye gadget, often that's because I feel I might feel some sense of lacking or some sense of not having enough thrill or excitement in life. And then I'll try to reflect on all the things I've done skillfully recently, all the wonderful interpersonal connections that my life allows me from being a teacher in this tradition. I might reflect on times that I've been at great peace in life. Now, sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't. Then what do I have to do is, well, sometimes what I'll do is I'll jump on my bike and I'll ride down to Chinatown, and I know this guy gives really cheap massages. You know what? I've never once regretted a massage, ever. I don't have very much money, and yet I can afford them. And in comparison to all the drugs and alcohol and the other stuff that I, you know, addictively purchase, I've never gotten addicted to them. I get a massage once every 3 weeks. And I'm a good friend with the guy. We write each other and we talk about each other's lives. And it's a lot of fun. It's a nice connection. Exercise, obviously. Just taking time out to release some endorphins. Terrific stuff. I highly recommend, obviously, developing many meditation styles that can bring you a great sense of ease. I, every day, go down also and I sit by the water and I try to watch either the sunset or I just try to get away and to try to just see something that's very peaceful. Every day have my neuroscience books that I read and get me out of my sense of self-ideation. I every day listen to some of the monks that I've studied with over the years. It's sort of a regular practice. I become so caught up in it that I've probably transcribed several hundred Dharma talks of my teachers just because I want to get their voices in this head up here. It gets me a nice break. All of these strategies I use as an alternative. All of the addictions we have in life are based on two tendencies. We want to soothe the mind or we want to thrill the mind. That's what addictions boil down to. So when I notice that I'm looking for someone to soothe me, I have a whole vocabulary of soothing behaviors that are not, that don't develop any sense of feeling less than. And when I'm looking for a thrill, boy, do I ride the fuck out of my bike around the city. I also have watched virtually every single English detective show there is. And I don't regret it for a minute. So I think to summarize, the questions we can ask, and you don't have to ask all five. You can just have one or two of these that you like. And just simply, when an obsessive thought arises, don't argue with it. Don't ask whether it's necessarily true, because even the most unskillful thought once in a while can be true. And you can talk yourself into believing that it's always going to be true. Don't act out on it or repress it. Instead, just notice, okay, what was I doing that brought it about? How can I expand the mind so that I can make it wider and much more spacious than the thought? Does this thought require actually noting it before it will pass, or is it something that requires a more aggressive form of either replacing the thought with a skillful activity, or does it require listening to the sensations, the physical sensations? In my case, with sadness, that's really the most important tool. We can notice what the allure is that the thought has for us and then remind ourselves of the drawbacks. When we honestly can see both the positive and negatives, we can decide with much greater efficacy whether or not we're going to attend to a thought or not. And many times it's good to develop a large vocabulary of safe activities and thoughts and reflections that are we can pick up instead. One of the safest reflections that the monk Ajahn Jeff taught me was Maranu Sati, which means reflection on death. And that sounds kind of negative, but there's nothing more powerful than when a thought repeats itself, to just simply ask myself, if this could be the last thought I ever had, would I be happy? Just sometimes asking that question alone makes it go away like that. Another trick he told me, which I don't use as well because it's sort of embarrassing, he said, whenever you have a thought, no matter what it is, just imagine if everybody could hear it. And if you wouldn't want everybody to hear it, why would you want to have such a thought? I'm not sure I want to. I'm not sure I want to share all my thoughts. Although the NSA probably knows everything I'm thinking anyway, so why care? That's a Snowden joke for those of you. All right, I've bamboozled you enough with all this information, so we're going to have, for the next few weeks, a bunch of different tools for working with obsessions. I hope you got something from tonight. I thank you for listening, and now we'll go quickly to some questions or shares about anything that tonight's topic raised. And if you are leaving, if you could, remember to contribute, if possible, to keep us in the space. I'd be very grateful.